Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Tammy Freeman, and I'm joined today by Mateen Jirani and Hamish Johnston.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi. In this week's podcast, we'll be taking a look at a startup company that's just received a big investment to develop its novel thin film ultrasound technology. We'll also be discussing why some startup companies have less success and why some business models just don't work. But first, we're going to hear from our Spain correspondent, James Dacey. Back in December, James attended COP25, the UN Climate Summit in Madrid. As well as all the political negotiators at the event, there were plenty of scientists and technologists taking part in discussions. They were there to talk about solutions to climate change and all the other interconnected global challenges relating to environment and health. James caught up with one organisation that's interested in something known as solar cooking. Here he is to tell us more.
Solar cooking is a way of heating food by focusing the sun's rays directly onto cookware. The beauty of this technology is that it requires no fuel and produces no smoke or soot. For that reason, it could provide health benefits to the billions of people in the world who currently cook over open fires. The absence of carbon emissions means this can also help to mitigate climate change. To find out more, I caught up with the physicist Alan Bigelow, who is the science director of Solar Cookers International, a non-profit organisation that researches and promotes solar cooking while building its capacity across the developing world. I began by asking Alan the obvious question: what is a solar cooker?
A solar cooker is a device that can collect sunlight and gather the sunlight on a cooking pan, which is typically black, very good at absorbing sunlight, and then that converts the energy of light directly to heat energy. We typically use simple greenhouse approaches as well in the designs, which helps retain the heat. But ultimately, the intention is that we can cook food using only direct sunlight, and this is a clean and sustainable form of cooking.
So why do we need these cookers?
Yeah. On our planet today, we have just over 7 billion people. And of those 7 billion, approximately 3 billion are still cooking over open fires. There are health implications when people are cooking over fire every day. They're breathing in smoke, which can lead to deleterious effects on the lungs, stunted growth, etc. But that could also, it involves the health of the planet in that you are emitting a lot of black carbon, and black carbon, meaning smoke, and as black carbon precipitates, it can land on glaciers, ice pack, and actually accelerate the melting of those, which then leads to sea rise. So there's a number of things with the rationale, and ultimately we are targeting women and girls primarily in the developing areas where they're still relying on firewood for cooking, and to access even firewood, it might require long journeys during the day of an hour or more. Some is 4 hours a day, depending on where the population is. Or it's a very expensive process. For instance, in Kenya and also in Haiti, we have recent numbers that show for a family that typically earns about $2 a day equivalent to a USD a day, they might be spending around $1 a day for access to either firewood or charcoal. So there's an economic incentive as well for families to use solar cooking, which is no cost for the fuel, just simply one needs to have a solar cooker that can capture that energy and convert it to heat for cooking.
So to come back to the technology itself, I mean, you gave a kind of overview of the rationale of how it works, but can you describe what these things look like and perhaps some of the materials that you use and the life cycle of those materials? You know, how long do these things last?
Sure. They tend to be shiny objects because we want to be gathering sunlight. Mm. So in some cases, they might look like a satellite dish, a parabolic dish, where the sunlight can be gathered at a focal area. And this doesn't necessarily have to be a focusing system, but close to a focusing system is actually better in that the target is a cook pot, which is fairly large in size. So we find that that actually can help keep the costs lower if you're designing something that doesn't have to have very precise focusing qualities to it. Other solar cookers might look like an oven. So this is something which would have a box inside a larger box, and the inner box would have black walls typically, and a window, possibly two windows for the light to enter the box. Then there's insulation between the inner box and the outer box to keep the inside warm. You will also see reflectors added to those boxes to gather more sunlight. Now, that's a good overview. Then I should say, when you look at going to scale, we have examples in India, primarily, where large systems of Scheffler dishes, and these are concentrators that can be mounted on the rooftops of schools, hospitals, temples, ashrams in India. And by concentrating sunlight to heat water to steam, then the steam goes down into an indoors kitchen, which is capable of cooking large numbers of meals per day, on the order of tens of thousands of meals per day, which is astonishing. And I've been fortunate to visit some of those facilities and tried the food.
You talked about a project in northern Kenya in a refugee camp, and some of the challenges of out in the field, the reality of using this equipment and the fact that you have to create rugged devices. I mean, do you want to tell us about that project in Kenya and some of the special considerations that you had to take into account?
Yes, the way we work at Solar Cookers International is through collaborators. And it's very important to have a local collaborator that, for one, can manufacture the solar cookers at a price that is affordable to the local population. And with that, they use primarily materials that are available locally. That's so important to keep the price low. The local connection also brings value to those solar cookers that are built there, because there's an understanding of what type of solar cooker would work best for the foods that are locally consumed. Mm. So in the case of working in northern Kenya, we're also needing to be very conscious of the environment. It's very harsh. We're working with a collaborator called Eco Mandate Foundation, building Fresnel lens-based systems, but also large solar box ovens. The region of northern Kenya can be extremely dry. It can also be humid during the rainy season, which is very short. And the temperature fluctuations are also, it's a wide range of temperatures. But during the hot and dry days, there is also intense solar irradiation. So these factors are very important for the choice of materials in the design of the cooker. So we found actually that we needed to be very, very conscious of that. If you use wood, for instance, the low humidity days in northern Kenya could actually extract so much moisture from wood that it led to warping. So we decided, instead of using wood, we had to use steel framing for some of the systems.
Kakuma Refugee Camp was established in 1992 following war in Sudan and the collapse of the government in neighbouring Ethiopia. Today, the camp has more than 190,000 registered refugees and asylum seekers, many of whom rely on wood and charcoal stoves to prepare their food. To find out how solar cookers are helping at Kakuma, I caught up with Caitlin Hughes, the Executive Director of Solar Cookers International. Caitlin describes a case study of a woman in the camp.
So I'd like to introduce you to Hera Rimana. She is a woman who lives in Kakuma Refugee Camp. And obviously, being a refugee, she has already faced so many challenges in her life. And a challenge that a lot of people don't actually know about is the struggle to be able to cook food. She has children, and in Kakuma refugee camp, you can't just plug in a microwave or turn on a gas stove. That infrastructure doesn't exist. So she's left with the difficult decision or options to try and go out and collect firewood, which there isn't very much of. If she leaves the camp, then she's at risk for gender-based violence, which is heartbreaking and nobody should have to experience. Or she can trade her food rations, the precious little amounts of food that she gets to try and feed herself and her family, in order to try and get the fuel to cook it. And this is a heartbreaking decision. But with solar cooking, she does not have to make that decision. She does not have to risk snake bites or conflicts with the local communities or having less to eat. She actually can cook her food right in her own very yard, right in her compound, using the sustainable power of the sun. And it's a healthy, sustainable way. She doesn't have to breathe in smoke. The pollutants from cooking over an open fire can be equivalent to smoking 400 cigarettes an hour. With solar cooking, there's none of that. It's clean air for her and for her children, which is a beautiful thing.
Excellent. And I know Alan gave me a nice demo of the device earlier. I mean, have you actually sampled the food? What's it like? Can you tell it's been cooked using a special cooker?
I've done more than sampled. I'm a regular solar cook myself. I've made lasagna, enchiladas, quiche, brownies, cookies, curries, all kinds of dishes, and also solar dehydrated. And that can be an important aspect, not just for when I'm going backpacking, but also for food security for people in many of these vulnerable communities. I just use recipes like I would regularly, put it out in the sun, and then get back to work, actually. So it's nice for multitasking and addressing these important issues.
Practice what you preach. It's important.
Exactly. Yep.
Any particular developments coming in the next year, in 2020, that you want to highlight?
Yeah, so we're going to build off of these connections and relationships that we're developing now. So I imagine we'll continue working in these areas of greatest need with these people that we've met, because the solution is something that's needed more now than ever.
Alan Bigelow is also a keen solar cook, and he regularly gives public demonstrations in the New York area. Before beginning his role at Solar Cookers International, Alan worked at Columbia University Medical Center, where he developed technology for radiation biology studies. I wanted to know more about his intriguing career path.
So you yourself, you've had a very interesting career. You trained as a physicist, and I know you worked within kind of more applied pure physics before making this shift to development work while still using some of your skills. So what motivates you, and what made you make that jump, that leap of faith?
Yeah, my PhD thesis was at the University of North Texas in the particle accelerator laboratory that's in the basement of the building where most particle accelerators are kept. And I used those skills at a postdoc position at the Columbia University Medical Center, and then worked at a radiation biology laboratory for a good 15 years. Well, during that time, I found out about solar cookers and started using them. I should mention that my childhood, when I was growing up, my father was working at the U.S. State Department, but basically overseas in countries around the world. So we would see fairly often how people live, these 3 billion people out of 7 billion today, who are still needing to cook over open fires using firewood. And as a child, I witnessed the struggle that a lot of women and girls had to go through to access this very basic energy that's needed for cooking. So when I first saw a solar cooker, I had two perspectives. One as a physicist, where I saw it and I thought, that's going to work. That device, the one example I was first looking at, that can capture sunlight and convert the energy of light to heat. You could cook food with that. But my other perspective was from the memories of my childhood, where I realized this device, this approach to cooking, could help so many people on this planet to reduce their use of firewood and charcoal, and help them economically and benefit for their health as well.
So, I mean, one of the sort of common traits of a physicist is this obsession with standards. And I know one of the challenges over the past few years is developing an international standard. Up until recently, anyone could claim their solar cooker was the best in the world. And that's not very useful, is it, if you're trying to buy one? So, yeah, talk me through that process and where you're at the moment.
You're right. It's very confusing to the consumer if manufacturers are all saying that their product is the best in the world. And that had been the case. We're trying to change that now. I should specify that at Solar Cookers International, we're a nonprofit organization. We also do not manufacture solar cookers. Hence, we're well positioned to offer testing services to the sector without having a perceived conflict of interest. During the past 5 years, there has been an initiative at the International Organization for Standardizations to produce standards for testing clean cook stoves and clean cooking systems. I've become a member of the U.S. delegation to that technical committee 285. And over these years, we have developed and now published, just in the past 2 years, the field testing standards and the laboratory testing standards for clean cook stoves at large. And within that are solar cookers. And having been on the committee that generated these standards, which are now being implemented, we were able to jump right away onto the standards required for testing solar cookers according to ISO. And now we have developed instrumentation to do those tests. And we have placed that instrumentation at 4 sites, one in California, one in New York, where I live. Basically, it's at my home office, and also in Nepal, and most recently at the University of Nairobi in Kenya. So we have 4 locations worldwide right now where solar cookers can be tested according to ISO standards.
For more information about solar cooking, take a look at my article on the Physics World website with the headline, Cooking with the Sun. That includes a short video where Alan Bigelow demonstrates how to assemble a solar cooker. It's worth watching just to see the big shiny paraboloid reflector. You never know, it might even inspire you to take up solar cooking.
Thanks, James. Now I'm here with Hamish, who recently spoke to Dave Hughes, founding director of Novosound. Now, Novosound was established in 2018 as a spin-out from the University of the West of Scotland. So, Hamish, what technology is Novosound developing?
Well, the company makes systems that are used in non-destructive testing. And that testing is done using ultrasound. And one product that they offer is a flexible array of detectors that can be placed on an object like a pipe. So the detector sort of conforms to the shape of the object, which is very important. And at the heart of their sensor technology is a flexible piezoelectric thin film. Now, at the moment, I think their main customers are the oil and gas industry. But according to Dave, there's lots of other applications, industrial applications, but also medical applications, veterinary, dentistry. Okay. And I think Dave points out to me in the interview that that it could be possible to create an ultrasound system, a medical ultrasound system with the same resolution as MRI, which would be real
impressive. Yeah, and Novosound has been very successful so far. So last October they won the Business Startup Award from the Institute of Physics, and then just last month the company received $3.3 million investment.
Yeah, that's right. 2019 has been a great year for Novosound, and that's why I was really keen to catch up with Dave. And in the interview that you're going to hear, he begins by explaining what Novosound does.
Okay, at Novosound, we set out to push the limits of ultrasonic imaging and measurement utilising thin film technologies That's just marketing waffle for saying that we sell sensors. We're a hardware manufacturing business that sells ultrasonic sensors to industrial and medical markets.
And what are what are some of the markets that you sell into?
Okay, so the markets in the industrial sector are like the oil and gas inspection and the aerospace imaging markets. And then in medical, we're targeting the wearable sector of the medical market.
Now, the technology was developed in Scotland, and I understand that that you played a major role in that. Where was it developed?
So the technology was originally developed at the University of the West of Scotland, which is inside a town called Paisley, just outside of Glasgow. I was a research fellow there inside the Institute of Thin Films, Sensors and Imaging, where I had a research group looking at ultrasonic uses of thin film technology.
What were your research goals? Were you looking? Was it a purely scientific exploration that you were doing, and you suddenly realized that there would be applications, or were you looking at looking for applications?
I've always been very applications focused in all of my research. I always think that blue sky science is great, but if you want to have real impact, you have to get it out of the laboratory and into the real world. So my original research was looking at ways of making high-resolution ultrasound sensors using conventional materials. These are single crystals or piezo composite materials, but they all suffer from manufacturing challenges that don't make them particularly commercially viable for scalable manufacturing of high-resolution sensors. I then switched over to using a thin film-based method for the manufacturing instead, and it became much more commercially viable. So by tapping into some of the commercialization funding available in Scotland, I did a few proof-of-concept industry projects with commercial partners and then got my own grant to enable me to effectively commercialize my research group and build a business plan, raise investment, and take my research group out of university and create Novasound.
And when you say high resolution, is that in terms of the frequency of the detected sound, or is that a high a spatial resolution that allows you to do ultrasound images?
So it's a mixture of both. With a high resolution ultrasound signal for industrial monitoring, the increased frequency obviously reduces the wavelength, which means that you get a good axial resolution along the direction of the beam. But also if you start making these into focused imaging probes for acoustic microscopy, you also increase the spatial resolution as well. And due to diffraction limits and diffraction laws, the higher frequency, so we're talking above 50 megahertz up to 100, 150 megahertz, you start to get sub-20 micrometer imaging resolutions, both axially and spatially inside water. So that's imaging resolutions inside water and also tissue, because you approximate that water and tissue are much the same thing.
And can you give us sort of a real life example, say in the oil and gas industry or aerospace industry, of how the technology would be used?
So in the oil and gas industry, high resolution is very useful for monitoring the effects of corrosion or erosion at earlier time points than if you had a lower resolution, because you can see more gradual changes faster. Although in the oil and gas industry, what we found is that high resolution, great, is something that the industry is looking for in the future. A more immediate requirement is ultrasound sensors that continue to operate at high temperatures, elevated temperatures, because sometimes pipes in the oil and gas industry become very warm. And with the current materials, they have what's known as a Curie temperature. That means that the acoustic efficiency drops off, so the sensors cease to work. This new material that we're using for our ultrasound sensors, as well as being high resolution, is also non-ceramic, so it doesn't have this Curie temperature or this limitation, meaning that with the same high-resolution sensor, you can measure and monitor erosion and corrosion at higher temperatures for continuous monitoring. And that's really where our selling point inside the oil and gas market came from. you move towards the aerospace industry, and it's actually more in the flexibility of the probes. It's the same ultrasound sensor that's high resolution and operates at temperature is also much more flexible than traditional probes, allowing you to image and measure complex geometries. There is nothing that is on an there's nothing on an aircraft that's flat anymore. Everything is built for aeronautical efficiency, but nothing's designed for inspection. So when you have these $100 million assets up in the air, they need to be inspected somehow. And when they're on the ground, they get taken off, they get inspected. And when they're on the ground, they're not making money. And prolonged inspection costs more money. If you have a probe that can fit all these different shapes, you can inspect it faster and get it back into the air quicker.
And what were some of the main challenges that you faced when you were trying to commercialize the technology, sort of moving it out of the lab and into industry?
The biggest challenge you have with a new technology or a technology that improves upon an existing technology is the inertia that you find with customers who are using what they're used to, and you come along with a new way of doing it. You have to really evangelize your technology to an extent that you get the first person to say, yes, I want to test that. And you might not get paid for the testing, but at least you start to get case studies too. Everybody's waiting for the first person to use it because they're interested, but they don't want to put the risk down. So as soon as they see somebody's using it, you start to open the floodgates to an extent. We're kind of at that point at the moment. We spent a lot of time going out face-to-face to speak to potential customers and partners to find the initial people that would test it and put a name to it, or basically allow us to use their name to say, this is this new technology that replaces what you're currently using is used by X, big engineering company, therefore you should use it too. And it all builds faith in the technology to be the direction that the industry needs to go. So as I say, we're 18, 19 months old as a company at the moment, and we're just getting to the cusp and the crest of being able to have that kind of name recognition against the technology.
And you mentioned oil and gas and aerospace. Are there other possible applications that you could explore, you know, for example, medical?
Yes, I mean, for example, an ultrasound sensor is an ultrasound sensor. It's a bit of material that uses the piezoelectric effect to generate sound. So anytime that you have a new technology that does this and captures the piezoelectric effect, you can effectively sell your sensor anywhere the ultrasound is used. So my background is I did a degree in physics and an engineering doctorate in medical devices. That's where I started using researching ultrasound back in 2005, 2006. And ultimately, Novasound is aiming to hit the medical market in about 3 to 5 years with the high-resolution ultrasound. That would enable effectively images collected with an ultrasound that provides the resolution of an MRI, but without the associated costs that you get with an MRI.
And the company has just received a £3.3 million investment. I'm guessing that's a game changer for you. What does that mean for the direction of the company over the next few years?
Yes, so we just closed our Series A investment with a London investor group called Foresight Group in partnership with Williams Advanced Engineering. That's the engineering research arm of the Williams Formula One team. They do a lot of non-destructive testing as part of building these really fast cars. So for us, it's a game changer because it gives us the credibility of Williams Advanced Engineering has done technical due diligence on our technology and passed it to this extent that we've raised $3.3 million from them plus our existing investors that followed the money. It really allows us to scale the operation. We started a year ago with 6 people. We're now 22, and over the next 12 months, we hope to double that to really build a world-class R&D team inside Scotland to really launch these advanced ultrasound products to the industrial market, perhaps through Williams as a partner or, you know, the other people we're speaking to, and then start to make inroads towards the medical markets.
So is finding people, is that going to be a challenge? Are there enough, you know, sort of talented people in this field in Scotland that you could recruit?
Scotland is a great place to do an ultrasound company at the moment. There's about four or five universities that are doing leading edge ultrasound research, bolstered by the grant funding ecosystem that's for universities. And we haven't had a challenge so far to find the ultrasound part of the business. Other parts, such as your commercial teams or your electronics teams, that becomes harder. But as our name gets out, we become, and we've noticed we get a lot more CVs coming into our inbox than having to go out and find people now, that we've become more of a name in Scotland. So that really helps. And I expect that with all the PR that's just been out this week about the investment round, that's going to continue. But really, recruitment is probably the hardest part of my job, because you can't get a technology out to market unless you have the right team to do it. I've been very fortunate in that I've built a world-class team around me, and with a really strong belonging in the culture. So we're all working on this great new technology, and we're all in sight and all aligned to the same goal.
And what would your advice be to a young physicist who's who's interested in you know, sort of going into industry and maybe pursuing a technology that they've worked on in an academic setting? What would be your top tips for success?
The biggest challenge and mistake I think I see, and I did it myself when I first thought about trying to sell my technology that I had delivered in the lab or developed in the lab, was that the customer that I saw was myself and my own, you know, myself, but to other research institutes. For example, I'm working high resolution ultrasound, so X, Y, and Z over those institutes, so therefore I will sell to them. You have to get out of the mindset of just selling to other academics and other universities. That's what we know as academics. The big game-changing sales and the big commercial markets are away from the universities. World-class research also happens outside of the university ecosystem, but as academics and PhDs and doctorals and postdocs, we get a lot of tunnel vision to think that university is the pinnacle. That's where you have to be, and that's where you're going to sell your leading-edge tech to. You have to look outside the walls of the university and start looking, going out to speak to customers, go and speak to the big manufacturers or the big service providers in your field, and you'll find that they have problems that they don't know that you are solving because they don't read papers. You have to get out and speak to them and see the whites in their eyes and find out what their challenges are. I think looking back over all the support that you get to become an entrepreneur from universities, the bit that always seems lacking is they will train you how to pitch and how to talk about your research in a human way, or a layman's way, as they call it. I think the best thing that an academic can do is to learn how to negotiate, so that when they're out trying to make their own way in the world as an entrepreneur, you get rid of the safety net. You have to learn how to negotiate. And that's something that I'm kind of learning every day. And I guess that's my biggest bit of advice, would be get some negotiation training and then you'll be fine.
And were there any particularly useful resources that you made use of, either, you know, in the university, government, or industry organizations?
So the biggest resource we used at the very start was our technology transfer office, the enterprise offices at the university. They got us in contact with Scottish Enterprise, and this is very Scotland-centric because there's a lot of support in Scotland for creating spin-outs. At Scottish Enterprise, which is the government funder for university enterprise commercialisation activities, we got put in touch with their high-growth spin-out scheme. And in 2016, I was awarded quite a sizable grant for 2 years to enable me to prove the concept of the technology, get working prototypes, but also prove the concept of a business. And that allowed me to team up with my current business partner, Richard, who we met in March 2016. I was able to pay him 2 days a week from the Scottish Enterprise grant, and we've kind of been joined at the hip ever since. As an academic, I had a wee bit of business sense, but not much. And Richard came on board as a mentor. But day one, we kind of said that we're only going to do this now is if in 2 years' time I was going to be leaving the university to go into the business. And I kind of, as soon as I started dipping my toes into the entrepreneurial world and the pace it moves and excitement and actually seeing my technology being used out in the world, I got a buzz from it, and there was no question of not leaving the university. So with that immense support from Scottish Enterprise and the university, coupled with the mentoring and the business planning that I did with Richard, that's how we ended up with our seed round of investment in April last year, and really kick-started the business at that point.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Dave.
So Novasound is a young company that appears well set on the road to success. But not all new businesses do so well. In an article in the January issue of Physics World magazine, James McKenzie, Vice President for Business at the Institute of Physics, explains why some business models just don't work out. He started by introducing the example of the Juicero. Mateen, what's a Juicero?
What's a Juicero? I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it properly. I'm not sure if it's Juicero or Juicero.
Juicero, maybe?
Juicero. Either way, it's a product, or was a product, as we'll come to later, that cost $399. It's connected to the Wi-Fi, and it allows you to create fresh fruit juices by squeezing pouches of fruit that you order online.
Okay.
So it's one of those business models, a bit like, I guess you get coffee machines where you buy the machine and then you have to put the pellets
yeah,
in.
Yeah, the pods in.
Or
yeah.
You get, I suppose it's also like razors. You buy the razor blades afterwards, or it's a bit like conventional printers, inkjet printers or laser printers, where you buy the printer and then you've got to spend all that money buying cartridges.
Yeah.
So it's a well-known business model of you buy a product and then the company makes money by selling the things that you need to operate it. In this case, it's the fruit pouches.
Okay.
So, I mean,
there's fresh fruit in a pouch.
I think so, yeah. So, you know, it was the Silicon Valley thing. So it was founded by this guy, Doug Evans, as the first at-home cold-pressed juicing system. And it was launched in 2016 to great fanfare. And it got loads of investment from people like Alphabet, which is the company behind Google. So it was all these Silicon Valley entrepreneurs thought this was a fantastic idea of all these cool hipsters ordering these pouches of fresh fruit, staying healthy, you know, popping in their machine. And, you know, it was destined for great things. However, it didn't.
And why was that?
Well, if you think about it, so all you have to do, as Ian McKenzie says in the article, all you have to do is buy the machine, register the device, download the app, order this produce pack, which costs between $5 and $7, wait for it to arrive, scan a QR code, and then ensure the internet-connected device has checked the quality of the product because they didn't want people drinking manky fruits. So it's really complicated,
yeah.
And you can simply go down to your local convenience store and buy a juice or buy some fruit and squeeze it yourself in your hand, or just, you know, buy a mechanical device. So it was something that was overly complicated.
Right.
And in 2017, it went bust.
Okay, so way too complicated, bit of a crazy idea, as you say, if you could just go and buy juice or squeeze an orange yourself.
Well, apparently the story was there was someone at Bloomberg magazine who just realised these pouches you could just squeeze with your hand. You didn't need all this fancy Wi-Fi connected device.
Get the same juice.
Yeah. And of course, people just laughed at it. And it was sort of an example of Silicon Valley hubris and, you know, just the over-engineered solutions that...
Yeah.
Seemed a great idea, but didn't work in practice.
Could you put your own fruit in the juicer, or did it have some sort of way of blocking you from doing that?
Well, I don't know, but it just seemed overly complicated and, went bust. But the point of the article that James McKenzie's saying is that it seemed a crazy business model and it didn't work. But some crazy business models, if they work, well, then they're not crazy at all. And
okay.
As long as you kind of get your product right and it works, then it's done really well.
So how did he suggest that a new business could maximise its chances of a success?
Well, I think that's what he's saying. I think as physicists, I mean, you know this, Hamish, you as well, Tammy, you've met loads of physicists. They get really keen on the technology that they've developed without thinking, what's the market? What problem does it solve? Is it going to make someone's life easier? And is it set at the right price?
Mm.
I mean, last week, do you remember we talked about the graphene headphones that Margaret tried on? And we all had fun testing those, and they were great. But, you know, are they going to work? Who knows? There's all sorts of other factors at play.
And lots of other high-end headphones that you could buy that may or may not sound just as good.
In the article, James McKenzie, he also tells the story of a health tech firm, Theranos. Now, this is such a shocker. It's apparently going to be made into a Hollywood movie. So what happened here?
Well, yeah, this was a firm set up by Elizabeth Holmes, who was a sort of, who was then a sort of 19-year-old Californian business person who modelled herself on Steve Jobs wearing the same jumpers and stuff. And she had this sort of, I mean, you'll know more about this than me, Tammy, had a sort of medical kit that could, using just a pinprick, a test that you might have at a supermarket, could diagnose all sorts of diseases.
Okay, that sounds like a great idea. Yeah.
So it was all going swimmingly well. And then in 2015, someone from the Wall Street Journal, an investigative reporter, looked into some of the, or questioned the validity of what this company was doing. And then in 2018, it was charged by the US Securities and Exchange Commission with fraud.
So was it completely made up?
Well, there were some claims that they'd had revenue of $100 million, and actually it was much less than that. And but the point that James McKenzie makes in the article, actually, this idea of sort of finger prick blood tests being diagnosed at your local pharmacy or supermarket is a fantastic idea.
It is, yeah.
And isn't it a pity that this company got caught up with maybe technology that didn't quite work, or there was this problem with the fraud?
Yeah.
But in principle, it was a really good idea. And as you say, it's all going to be made into a film called Bad Blood, starring Jennifer Lawrence.
Excellent. I will make sure I see that one. So you can read more about this on the Physics World website in the article Bad Business Models.
Yeah, and the point, as I said, if it's a mad idea but it works, then it's not crazy. But if it doesn't work, then it certainly was crazy.
Or I suppose in the example of Theranos, if it sounds like a great idea and should work, it might not necessarily work. Yeah. So beware.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks to Mateen and Hamish for joining me today, and a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. Finally, if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app, and we're also on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week. Physics World.